everyone, and happy Friday, and welcome to Minute 40 of Season 3 of Movie Around Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1998 Bruce Willis action flick, Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and joining me today is Duncan Shields of the Time Bandit Minute. Welcome back to the show, Duncan.
Thank you for having me again.
Why not? You might want to have a little bit of something, a bite to eat while you're talking to all the hostages. So just, make yourself at home.
Okay.
So minute 40 begins with a shoe flying across the corridor and encountering holiday ornaments, and ends with Hans lovingly talking about Takagi.
Yes.
So we ended yesterday's minute with, McLean trying on a pair of shoes that should have been too big for him, but in the end they were too small.
Yes.
Anyone out there who wants to agree or disagree with what Duncan and I said yesterday, feel free to let us know if you think that, McLean's feet should have been easily been able to fit into Tony's shoes.
I have a revolutionary theory here.
Okay.
McLean's sister is 7 feet tall.
Ah.
So the shoes were, in fact, 3 sizes too big for McLean.
Oh, wow.
So they were useless to him, but they were still smaller than his sister's.
Hey, that's great. That works.
That's how I'm making it fit in my head.
I'll go with you on that one.
All right.
So McLean is very frustrated, and he kicks off the shoe, and it hits some holiday decorations that are on the side. Now, did you notice that on the wall next to him, there's a big chart that says Raiders and Rams?
Yeah, yeah.
And
he's got this 10x10 grid with Raiders, yeah, on the Raiders on the X and Rams down the Y. Bunch of red and black notations on all the squares and some scribbles on the side. One date circled, the rest have notations. I don't know what that means.
No idea what that means, because the Raiders never play. If they're going to play each other, generally each team plays each other team once.
Yeah, sure.
During the season. So,
I guess it's a chart. It's a chart of when they play each other, or just when they're playing at all, to see if the dates overlap, like for organizing.
Maybe what's circled is the day that they actually play against each other on each of them. I mean, it's a little too far to read everything that's there. But yeah, maybe all the others are slots where, they're actually who they're playing.
They're playing somebody else. Yeah, yeah.
But there's also it's 10 by 10. And, in football, you play 16 games. So yeah, I'm not really sure what they're trying to show here.
I don't know.
Don't know. But I thought it was an interesting thing to have on the wall there.
It's either for organizing attendance or for placing bets or something like that. I really want somebody who's listening to get in touch and say, just tell us what this is, because it looks like the kind of thing that would be hanging on a lot of construction sites or a lot of people's rooms all the time.
Yeah.
But it might be unique to Los Angeles, because New York and Los Angeles are the only two cities that have at least 2 teams in all 4 major sports franchises.
Right.
Which makes sense, because they're the largest and second largest cities and the 2 largest metropolitan areas in New York. So the LA has the Chargers and the Rams for football, the LA Kings and the Mighty Ducks for hockey, even though they're Anaheim, it still counts. And LA Dodgers and the LA Angels for baseball, and the Clippers and the Lakers for basketball. So maybe that gets really confusing. So you need charts like this.
Yeah, but the irony is that in 1988, when this is taking place, so both the Raiders and the Rams were still in LA, but both of them moved out. The Rams eventually went to St. Louis in 1994, and the Raiders moved to Oakland. They were in Oakland, and then they went to LA, and then they moved back in 1994. So in 1994, they both moved out of LA.
I see.
So I wonder what team was left. I'm not that big of a football fan, so I couldn't tell you what. And the Raiders are now in Las Vegas. That shocked me.
I'm pretty sure the football is the game with the pointy ball.
That I know. I know what
that's,
game it is.
That's but pretty much the beginning and ending of my deep, deep football knowledge. So, yeah, I don't know.
Well, they have Canadian football, don't they? Or is the ball different?
No, we have Canadian football. We've got the BC Lions here. It's not.
No, but
It's
is it the same bowl?
the same ball. We have soccer and we have football,
Ah,
even
okay.
though soccer is called football in
Yeah.
the literal rest of the world.
Yes, I'm very familiar with that. Both of
Yeah.
my sons are big soccer slash football fans, and they love playing it, and I can't stand it. I think it's one of the most boring games in the world, but I can sit through a baseball game. So I don't know. It's like
It's a different strokes, right? I know. I remember
apparently, yeah.
seeing a baseball game in person with professionals is edge of your seat excitement. Watching it on television, I will fall asleep in 30 seconds. It's the same with golf. It's the same with snooker. It's the same with soccer. You see them in person, it's an entirely different experience. You watch them on TV. Like, I never understood the big deal about soccer because I was like, oh no, it was 1-0. It was 2-1, and I'm like, this was a scintillating game.
Yeah,
This was
or
fun to
even worse, the end of the game was 1-1. They
yeah, right?
tied. It's like, how can you tie? Even though I think they now changed baseball that you can tie, but I don't know. But
Yeah, it's an interesting chart. I'd like to know more about the chart and what it means.
yeah, but I mean, you have all your Canadian sports also.
Yeah, we got lacrosse, the official sport of Canada, lacrosse. The official sport of Canada isn't hockey, it's lacrosse, which is
I actually didn't even think it was hockey. I thought it was what's the name with the brooms? What's the
Oh,
one with the
curling.
brooms?
Curling,
Curling.
curling.
Curling, curling,
Yeah.
curling. Yeah.
And competitive poutine eating, I think, is another national sport that I like to partake in sometimes.
Okay. I don't know what that is. It
Oh,
actually
sorry.
sounds a little racy.
No, poutine's a dish. It's a Quebecois French dish from Quebec and Montreal that Canada's kind of just taken on as a national dish, and so you can get a little bit of a debate about that. But it's French fries, cheese curds, and
Oh, okay.
gravy, and it's you have to prepare the fries specifically. And anyway, it's not germane to the
Okay.
minute,
No,
but
it doesn't have to be germane to the minute. It's germane to
it's
Duncan
a
Shields.
A Canadian delicacy, and if you are unaware of the existence of poutine, if you can find some in your area, seek it out and try it. Your life will be forever enriched.
Okay, great. So John then looks over and sees these various Christmas ornaments that include two Santa Clauses. Now, my biggest question is why are they storing this stuff here on the 32nd floor on Christmas Eve? You'd think that they would have already put it out somewhere. It's not as if
Yeah.
it's not as if you're just talking about, having a little extra ribbons or something like that. You're talking about having a Santa Claus. So, on Christmas Eve, you want it to be somewhere that people are going to see it. What are they holding it? You're keeping it for next year? I mean, it's not the, this it's use it now or lose it, that type of thing.
Well, I think the company has a lot of money and they bought a tremendous amount of decorations, and they were behind schedule and they set up most of it, but there is still some kicking around.
Apparently.
That I don't know. I don't know why it would be way up on the 32nd floor instead of, like, I could see it being off the lobby in a closet or something, but I don't know what it's doing on the 32nd floor. But maybe it's just for the workers. Like, gosh, I don't know. They could use a few Christmas lights and Santa Clauses.
But the
Why not?
workers are actually not invited to the party. You're talking about the construction
No.
workers.
Yeah, but they were working on that, yesterday, I assume. So I assume it's just Christmas shenanigans for people with families that are working on the building, or not even people with families, just the workers themselves. Why not get a little decoration going?
Okay, that's possible. And then we see that McLean looks over and starts smiling. And the thing I love about this is that when he looks over and starts smiling, the music changes a little bit, and we get it sounds like
Yeah.
it's something that's coming from like a music box or something like that.
Yeah,
Like
yeah.
it's playful music, and he smiles, and as he's smiling, you can see Tony, still lying dead behind him. In the shot, you see
Well,
his face.
and this is the problem, right? He's got this trademark endearing half smile. Like, he's a little scamp. He's a little scamp. And but then he's gonna literally dress up a corpse. So, like, did you ever get the Body Worlds exhibit
Yes, I believe so.
coming
I
through
believe so.
Bridge? Yeah. So I went to see it in London, and they had some regionally specific displays set up, And one of the regionally specific displays that they had set up was this skinless teen boy's body flying on a broom made of his own intestines while his skin flapped behind him like a cape and he was wearing Harry Potter glasses. Ooh. Now, like, I love the exhibit, but I found that one to be in shockingly poor taste. You know, like, and it's wild that that's where the line was for me. But I was like, you can have all these really interesting and well set up exhibits of literal dead bodies because it's very education. But once you make it topical and hilarious, like, here's the Harry Potter literal dead body, I'm like, I don't like that. I think you are too deep in this scene and you crossed the line. Like, that's not, I think so. So I find it a little macabre here that it's all good and jovial that he's dressing up a corpse for laughs. But I understand what the movie is, and you know, but yeah, it's just something that occurs to me.
That's fair. And then the shot changes, and we see the elevator switches, right? And what's great is you can actually see, first of all, he presses on 31 and then on 30, and then the door closes, and then the elevator moves a little bit, and then he stops it by flipping a switch, you know, that just turns it off. And at this point, we can actually see the plate that above the elevator, right? The buttons. Mm-hmm. And it says Nakatomi Plaza Executive Suite Express Elevator, High Rise Only.
Yeah.
And we can see that there are buttons for 28 through 34 and the lobby. Mm-hmm. Now, this actually sheds so much light on something that happened in the second week, or maybe it was even the third week of the show, where, okay, you know, the guard downstairs, which, again, I'm going to mention that he is a, to me, he's always been a John Larroquette doppelganger. You know, really looks like him. So he basically says, oh, just take the express elevator and get off where you hear the noise. Now, I always thought of the idea of an express elevator is that it goes from one floor to another floor. But apparently now they've explained here by showing it to us that the express elevator is the elevator that goes to the floors 28 through 34, you know, which then it makes more sense about the fact that
it won't even stop at the, you know, whatever, one through 22.
Exactly. Or one through 27. So then as the elevator stops, so John then pries open the doors with his hands, and then he has this long metal pole, you know, which, I don't know if you noticed it, but at the very beginning of this minute, we saw those poles right below the poster of the Raiders and Rams.
Oh, no, yeah. I didn't notice that. Good continuity.
Yeah, nice. It's a, what is it? Chekhov's pole. You know.
Chekhov's pole, yeah.
And, you know, there were actually a bunch of them there. There's not just one. And I'm trying to figure out what he's opening. Like, and where does he have this knowledge to be able to, there must be some latch or something like that that unlocks the elevator from the inside. Okay, but where does John McClane know to do this?
Well, this is what this whole sequence here, it feels unnecessarily complicated. Like, couldn't he just press L and then dash out before the doors close? Like, I don't know, maybe I'm missing something.
Well, his wife is there.
It's good.
He doesn't want to, he wants to save his wife.
It's good TV, as they say, and it makes McClane look like MacGyver, but I don't know why he doesn't just like press L for the lobby and then hop out before the doors close and then the body goes down where he wants it to go. This whole thing of getting it between 32 and 33, stopping it between floors, like doing these weird MacGyver switches, which is like, I guess you used to build elevators?
Yeah.
Like, why do you know
exactly
this? You know, like, It's like you said, I don't understand the sequence or why it's in the film, except to make McClane look like MacGyver, that he's, jury rigging something because this is how, you know, innovative and smart and resourceful he is.
Right. And we see that he has a screwdriver in his hand and he then uses the pole to unlock some sort of mechanism in the elevator shaft. And after he does that, he's able to pry open the outer door because, you know, you have the inner door of the elevator itself, and then the outer door that takes you onto the floor that you want to go to. So he has to open two doors there, and then he slides the metal pole out of the elevator across the floor, and then he takes that screwdriver that he has and jams it, you know, in the door, so that it doesn't, so that it will continue to keep the door open, right? You can tell that he has it's a flathead screwdriver. And then he, once again, uses his upper body strength here and lifts himself out of the elevator.
Yeah.
Gets on his stomach, in order to, turn around and reach in and flip the switch of the elevator in order for it to continue to begin to start moving again. And that's all we see of McLean here. And then the shot changes and we see Hans in the communal area, where all the hostages are being held. And first of all, he has a plate of food that he's holding and he's eating.
Oh,
I never
classic.
Noticed this. I never noticed this before.
It's the classic. It's the classic. You got to be eating an apple as the cool, calm, collected bad guy.
Right.
If you're eating while you're dressing down a room of people or a subordinate, then you have all the power. It's right. A scene that happens in every movie.
Right. I mean, it looks like he's eating some fancy dish. Maybe it's sushi or some
hors d'oeuvres or something.
Hors d'oeuvres or something like that. Exactly. But it's great. And then Hans begins giving a little bit of a speech, and he says, I wanted this to be professional, efficient, adult, cooperative. Not a lot to ask. Alas, your Mr. Takagi did not see it that way. So he won't be. And then we get cut off.
And we get I'm missing out on one of the best lines in the film.
You'll have to come back on Monday with everybody to listen to what that is.
Yeah. It's a great line. One of the best.
It's a great line.
He's throwing out real disappointed dad energy here. Really, I'm not angry, just disappointed. I wanted this to be professional. I expected better of you hostages. He's not getting that.
It works.
It works. The one thing I want to talk about just really briefly is I want to touch on this movie that I found from 1959 called The Crimson Kimono. It stars James Shigeta, who played Mr. Takagi. It's a great film about a couple of best friend Korean War veterans, a white guy named Glenn Corbett and James Shigeta, who are now police officers in San Francisco. And while tracking down the killer of a burlesque dancer named Sugar Torch, they both fall in love with the star witness played by Victoria Shaw. It was way ahead of its time, depicting interracial romance with all the levels that can go with that. The movie has kendo, Buddhism, karate, different kinds of Asian people who aren't just, quote unquote, Asians, like all the films of that time, and a very mature introspection about fitting in and how insidious racism can be. And it's from 1959, and, which is typical of Samuel Fuller, but it's way ahead of its time because,
what's it called again?
The Crimson Kimono. But I spent the whole film wondering where I'd seen the lead actor before, and then I looked him up and I was like, oh my gosh, it's Mr. Takagi. It's the guy from Die Hard, because he's 25 or something or 30 in this movie from 1959.
Oh, wow.
But then, so he's this dashing young American cop in the Crimson Kimono. And then he ended up playing Mr. Takagi way, way, way later in Die Hard. So I highly recommend if you can track it down. It's a very mature and really well done film. And it's great to see him as a young man acting his heart out in a great film.
Cool. That's great. So the script has a few little minor discrepancies here. First of all, when we ended yesterday's minute with McLean taking off the shoes, and it says that he's tossing them, and the continuation of that line is he tosses them into the garbage. Right. Because in the movie, he just throws it and it hits, the different decorations. But in the script, he takes them and throws them in the garbage. Then he pulls the body up and sets it down on his secretary's chair. He starts to push it along when he gets the idea and moves to a desk where he scribbles a note we cannot read on a piece of paper. Then his eyes fall on some Christmas decorations nearby. He smiles to himself. So what's great is his idea was first to write a note to Hans, and hook it to the body until he realized that, oh, why don't I do something a little more innovative? And then it says, a tight on McLean's back as he pushes Tony's bottle on a swivel chair into the elevator. Note, we cannot see Tony's head. I don't know why they have to have that direction in there. Camera adjusts as McLean pushes the buttons for the 34th and 30th floors. We notice he's got the dead man's machine gun and that a wooden desk ruler protrudes from McLean's back pocket.
I guess that's what he used instead of the screwdriver?
That's right. The elevator doors close and the car starts down. After it's dropped only half a floor, McLean forces the doors open with his fingers, stopping the car between floors. Using the ruler, he blocks open the inside doors, then opens the outside doors of the floor above with his fingers and pulls himself up onto the carpeted floor.
I keep thinking of like the elevator Minora and the elevator Majora. You know, you've got this double seal.
It cuts into the story. It says in the hostage room, the hostages have been gathered together in a group in the center of the open floor, guards flanking them. The elevators are barely visible from the edge of the group, which is where Ginny and Holly are sitting. Ginny winces, uncomfortable on the floor. Holly soothes her. Hans stands in front of them like a stern camp counselor in front of the assembled bunk.
Stern camp counselor. Nice.
It says, I wanted this to be a professional, efficient, adult, cooperative. Not a lot to ask. Alas, your Mr. Takagi did not see it that way. So he won't be. And then it gets cut off. So, again, they do it nicely. You know, I think that the way that,
I guess maybe
that it works in the final cut is better.
Yeah, and I think because it was a functioning office, rulers were lying around, but because it's a construction site, that changed to screwdriver because that's lying around.
Yeah, but I think it's better to use it's better to use a screwdriver because a screwdriver can really hold it. A ruler, I don't know. There's no angle on it.
I don't see how that would work. Yeah, it would. It's not a wedge. It would just slide over it. I don't know. I like the idea of the screwdriver too. Yeah, it works a lot.
I think
better.
So too.
And aside, if I haven't mentioned it, is that the Hungarian title for Die Hard was "Give Your Life Expensive," and the title of the sequel was "Your Life Is Even More Expensive," and the third part is "Life Is Always Expensive." So I think there's I can see it being like a sort of a you know, translate to the language and then translate it back to English kind of mismatch, you know, game of telephone or whatever, as a translation of Die Hard. But I like the literalness of it, like just give your life expensive. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah, that's great. I mean, I loved also the way that they translate things back and forth, for me, because, you know, I live in Israel, so all movies, you know, have their own Hebrew title also. And actually, the Hebrew title for Die Hard is it's Met Lichyot, which means dying to live.
Oh, that's great. Okay.
Yeah. And like the second one is Met Lichyot Shtayim. It's the, you know, dying to live 2 and 3 and 4. I mean, I'm sure if I remember, I'd have to go look it up to see if they have different names for all of them. But it always starts with dying to live.
And, yeah, I like that. I like that a lot.
Yeah. No, I think that's great. That's a great way to do that.
Is it the same? Does it have the same like subtext as English? Like, you know, like, oh, I'm dying to get into that exclusive party. So it's not it's the same thing. Like, oh, I'm just dying to live.
It's that same type of context. Yeah.
For great sure. Wordplay. Wonderful wordplay. Love it.
Yeah, for sure. All right. So every Friday we have a special surprise segment that my guests don't know about.
Okay.
I call it Weekend Surprise.
Okay.
Where basically there's much debate over Die Hard as to whether it is considered a Christmas movie or not. So, Duncan, do you think that it is a Christmas movie or do you think it is not a Christmas movie? And please please explain your answer in depth.
I just think that it is a Christmas movie because it takes place at Christmas and because some of the central plot points involve Christmas. Like, that's why he's in town. This moment coming up, the now I have a machine gun or whatever, the moment that's coming up is Christmas based. There's a lot of Christmas based stuff that happens in the movie. It's not the core of the film. It's not a giant Norman Rockwell painting. It's not all about Christmas. There are moments that tie it to the holiday. It's not just window dressing. So I would call it an unorthodox Christmas movie, but a Christmas movie nonetheless.
Okay, great. So do you want to one last time tell people where they can find Duncan Shields?
Just Google Time Bandits Minute. Go to Chronologically Speaking, the same thing. We've got Twitter. We've got a website. Or go to Anchor, all your podcatchers, all that kind of stuff. And or go to buyduncanshields.com or look up By Duncan Shields on Twitter and Instagram. And you know, fun times await.
All right, excellent. And finding me is very simple. Just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find my website, movierobminute.com. You can find me on Twitter, and you can find me on Facebook. So, Duncan, thank you very much for joining us this week. This was a lot of fun. I found it to be quite eye-opening, even with a broken neck. And it's always fun talking to you, always fun hearing your thoughts on the various movies that I decide to talk about. So thank you for taking the time to spend with us this entire week.
Excellent.
And
I'm always down to talk to you. It was good talking to you.
All right. I appreciate that. And I will see everybody on Monday when we have a new guest, and we'll have even more to talk about Die Hard. So until Monday, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.